realise that if they don't invest in primary care, they will bankrupt their health GDP. So, and I think the model, the UK model, it's interesting that for a third of my clinical lifetime, I think the NHS was looking overseas for better models of clinical provision. But in fact, actually, quite accidentally, we'd ended up with probably the most controllable health system model, and one where most general physician, general medical care occurs in the community, and a lot of the sort of prevention and disease follow-up occurs in the community, and it enables super specialisation in hospitals. So that's the other thing, specialists to become more specialised. And that model, I think most health systems now recognise that that model and the registered list, rather than a sort of private provision, is the most equitable and cost-effective. Mm. So there's lots of health systems that are trying to orientate more to the way we do things here. And of course, digital health, which we do a lot of work around as well, is quite an important part of that in letting you know where you are in terms of the provision of healthcare and who you need to focus on first and in what order.
Mm. Yeah, I remember having American friends who were astonished that, as a woman who's had two children, I've never seen either a paediatrician or a gynaecologist.
Yeah, exactly.
The GP's just,
well, they proliferate community care, but they're equivalent to general practice. It's actually not exactly the same, but their family doctor is definitely, I mean, they're paid less and are generally have a much lower status. So you tend to add community specialists to your provision as well. But even the US, the managed care in the US recognises they need a more general population approach to things. Otherwise, you know, they won't stop a lot of expense. So they might be doing it for economic reasons, but they're still driving towards a similar model. Mm. And there's things we can learn from the US because it's effectively a for-profit environment in most cases. They are pretty efficient about investing in cost-effective management programs, and we can learn from those. Is once you've determined that people have got problems, how can you look after them more effectively, basically? Mm, mm, mm.
So we covered this a little bit because you mentioned you went in. So how did the first lockdown impact on, I'm moving now more to your personal living through the pandemic. How did the first lockdown impact on what you were able to do? And did it change the way you work?
Well, I mean, for me, it impacted rather less because I don't actually live in Oxford. So I live most of the time in Birmingham, so I was commuting down from Birmingham. So it was a lot easier commute, that's for sure. It was a bit weird. I mean, you felt like it was a Hollywood pandemic film because, you know, they weren't mowing the grass outside and it started, and the streets were completely empty. And, you know, I could have crossed the road here with my eyes closed, I wouldn't have needed to look for traffic. And I think there were two or three of us in this building. But anyway, we didn't actually close this building or the other building we've got, which is about 100 metres away. But this building had very few people in it. The other one had about 25 or 30, or normally would have about 100 people in it. So yeah, that was a bit weird. Huge increase in meetings, actually. I already had a lot of meetings in my diary, but far more meetings, most of them online, even though I might be taking them here. I think the other thing that was, which I've missed, I have to say, although I then have to think about my eco credentials, is travel. So I think I've had one flight in the last 20 months, whereas normally I'd probably be twice a month, I'd be going somewhere. So that's been bad, because I think you're often meeting interesting people, different parts of the world, different perspectives, as well as doing whatever you're going to do. Normally it was giving a lecture or examining or something. So that's gone. Whether that'll ever come back, I'm not quite sure. So more of the conferences I've attended have been, you know, I've just been given a video talk. But I've stopped attending congresses. I think online congresses are not for me anyway. So I don't know whether what that's going to be like. And I think it's, you know, I think it's been difficult domestically as well, because my wife is in a similar area to me, and you know, we just rammed all the time.
Yeah, so your working hours went up.
Just ridiculous, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've actually taken more space than she has. I think she takes it even more seriously than I do. But I'll just miss a meeting if I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed that day or whatever. And we still had to publish a lot and still had to bring the grants in for the next stuff and still cope with more people in the department and all the rest of it. I'm quite embedded into the university as well, so I sit on council and I sit on quite a few of the council subcommittees and stuff. So that really increased as well, the sort of, because obviously the university response was from a senior management team was big, so that's been quite time consuming as well.
And do you think the provisions that were brought in across the university to protect people were adequate and well implemented?
The university did a good job, really. I mean, and I think, you know, we tried to make, quite a few departments did, we certainly tried to make people still feel they were part of a department, even if they were all working from home. So there were virtual coffee mornings, and we normally have a big fancy dress Christmas party every year. Last year we didn't, but we did a online pantomime, which was awful for those having to be in the pantomime. But I think
were you in the pantomime?
Yes, unfortunately. Yes.
So do you think the well-being of the people in your department held up fairly well?
I think it probably did. We've got a fantastic admin team here, who are, you know, really dedicated and took the responsibility to try and keep the, however big the department gets, it still feels like it cares about staff. I think they got that right. I think it's going to get more difficult though, because the length of time it's gone on for is just not sustainable, frankly. And I think, I don't know where we're going to end up, really. So I think the university, and we were obviously predicting a big loss over the last financial year and took a number of decisions there. But as it turned out, you know, the university has actually financially done well, because it's done so much stuff. It's obviously increased its grant income. There's been a lot more legacy. I think it's boosted its international status as an institution, even more than it was already. So it hasn't been bad for the institution. I mean, I think we'll have to wait and see where it's held. I mean, I think it has made a tangible contribution to the world, actually, in the last 20 months, way above its station, not least of which was the vaccine, which it's a tragedy that it's been as blighted as it has been latterly. But that's still the most used vaccine on the planet, and goodness knows how many lives have been saved through that. And you know, it should actually be by far the most used vaccine, because it's cheap and cheerful and easy to use, and its risks, albeit unfortunately it does have some risks, in the scheme of things are no greater than the alternatives,
and much less than getting the disease,
and massively less than getting the disease. Yeah, and who knows, the people, I mean, you can speculate, but the people who get these rare thrombotic effects, I think you could reasonably surmise that they would be more likely to get those same effects if they had the you know, that if they caught COVID. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Because there's obviously some weird predisposition to odd thrombocytopenic reaction. I mean, there is, the disorder is actually, it just shows how odd science is though, because actually it's a known risk factor with vaccines to get a immunological thrombocytopenic response.
This but, means blood clots.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just...
It's yeah, and then as part of it, you drop your platelets, which makes you more likely then to get a bleed associated with the clot. So it's both a clot and bleed at the same time. Mm. And there are one or two vaccines, which I'm not going to name, which have this associated with them, and I never knew that, and no GP
I've spoken
to. Vaccines
for other diseases, not for COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I.e. it is a known rare effect of immunisation, mm-hmm. and has actually happened with the mRNAs as well, but in lower numbers. So it is just one of the potential risks associated with vaccination. But you're talking about converting a sort of 1 in a million background risk into 2 in a million.
Mm.
Well, if you were that 1 in a million person, it's obviously tragic and awful and all that, but if you're going to get 12, 15 in a million if you get COVID and you've got all the other risks on top, then it seems like a no-brainer,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And no, COVID vaccination does not sterilise you, and no, it doesn't introduce a microbot that then allows you to be tracked. So, but that's been very unfortunate, because I think and it's, for some countries, been devastating, mm-hmm. so, because some of the countries with very, very low vaccine uptakes, Romania, Russia, Japan, are going to really get hit badly in this current wave. So,
did you personally ever feel threatened by the virus, or that people?
Yeah, I did actually, because not without going into it, I don't, you know, I'm old and have a number of risk factors. And actually, so it was weirdly early on, when would this have been? I did actually think that if I get it, it might kill me. And I sort of thought to myself, should I hide away? And because I could have done, just work from home and just, and decided no, I wasn't going to let it dictate how I lived my life, really. And then stopped thinking about it. Other than, you know, sensible precautions. But, yeah, so that's what I did think about it deep down. But as it turned out, I was infected quite early on, I think, as my...
Oh, you were?
Yeah, so...
Oh, right.
I was... My wife caught it in mid-March. She was teaching on a master's programme in Warwick. And quite a few of the doctors... It was all doctors, and they'd... Quite a few of them had been skiing, and two of them, and subsequently the whole cohort, were infected with COVID in March. That was before the first lockdown, a week before the first lockdown.
Right.
And so I know that I was infected at some point, because I did my antibodies at the end of 2020, which showed I'd had been infected, and I'm almost certain I was infected then, although I wasn't actually particularly ill. She was much iller than me.
But you were slightly ill. I mean, you were.
Yeah, and yeah. I felt off colour and had horrendous headaches, which I don't normally get headaches.
Mm. Didn't lose your sense of taste as well.
No, I didn't. I had really, given what I had been thinking in retrospect, stupidly, I got off remarkably mildly with symptoms. There were another couple of occasions when I was ill later in the year where it could have been then. It's just, I mean, obviously, once we realised she'd got COVID, I effectively barrier nursed her at home. But there was at least 24, 36 hours before we knew she was positive when she would have been infectious, so I think the chance of me not having caught it then were negligible.
Mm-hmm.
And I obviously caught it at some point, so I think it was then. So so yeah, it you can get it and survive it.
Mm.
And lots of people do. That's the weird thing about it. Mm-hmm. It's so unpredictable, Even amongst people with risk factors, the majority aren't going to get seriously ill with it, but some will.
So I need to move to wrap up because I see we're nearly out of time. So has the work you've done on COVID raised questions that you'd be interested in exploring in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think the particular area that we'll want to look at as soon as we can, actually, is long COVID. We'll be looking at whether any of the treatments which might not have been effective with COVID acutely might be effective in terms of long COVID. That's a completely separate and important question, where you might use treatments not for the initial illness, but because it might alter the illness trajectory. So that I think is an important area. I think we're still thinking about how we can integrate all of our digital assets. We've got quite a number of parallel digital assets, and whether we can actually be using those more efficiently, I think, is quite a big consideration for us, and also our relationship with the software suppliers who actually generate the clinical systems that extract the data. The relationship with them has been really quite important and much, much stronger over the last year or so. So those are two obvious areas.
Mm.
I think trying to resurrect non-COVID research is also important. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, you know, we are not going to eradicate this virus, and we therefore need to learn to live with it. And I think that'll become a feature, really, which is how you can reduce its impact on society. And try and return to a more semblance of normality at the same time as focus on the next, or perhaps the overwhelming issue facing society of climate change. But I think everybody's a bit knackered, really, and how you can bring everybody around from that and make them feel more positive about the where we go with the world, I think, is going to be a bit of a challenge, actually.
Mm.
You know,
and this is a slightly different question, but related. Has the experience of COVID changed your attitude or your approach to your work, and how would you like things to change in the future?
Well, I really enjoy my job, actually. I wouldn't necessarily admit that, but I do enjoy its variety, the amount of control I have over what I spend time doing, etc. But I do feel a bit weary now, so I don't know, really. What it's done for a lot of my colleagues is get them to decide to retire early and focus on other important things like grandchildren and, you know, generational stuff. So I suppose I think more about whether I should be thinking like that. I don't know whether I will or not, but I think I should think more about that. And I think quite a lot of people of my sort of generation are thinking more like that. And, you know, worrying about what, because it's really the next generation and certainly the grandchildren who are really going to have suffered the economic consequences of. So once again, I think I've been fortunate enough to live at a time when we never had it so good, frankly, as a society, the adults in society, even the ones who, you know, need support from the state to survive, they've actually never had it so good either, because I think things are going to get tougher, and so I don't really know what is going to happen. And clearly, you know, the world's in a terrible state when you look at equity and distribution of population and simple stuff like enough food to eat and whether your population's growing in a sustainable or non-sustainable way. We might be very advanced technologically, but we're not very advanced in terms of our governance structures or anything. In fact, I don't think we're advanced beyond where previous civilizations were several thousand years ago. But at least we haven't got slavery now. Well, no, we don't have slavery like they had it then. But other than that, I think, you know, Greek and Roman and societies like that were probably as advanced as ours and more durable, really. But, yeah, so I don't know. What do you think? Where do you think we're going to end up?
I think we're going to hell in a handcart, but that's... Yeah, no, it's difficult to feel optimistic at
the moment. Well, I think that's the point, though.
I'm going to stop.
It is. I think that